All right, we're in Building 41 again, DLR World. Who are you, John?
I'm John Lamb. I work on the Iron Ruby project at Microsoft.
Outstanding. We've had you on Channel 9 before.
Yeah, when I first got here.
Right on.
Yeah.
Welcome again.
Thank you.
Should I start laughing? Laugh out loud?
No.
All right.
I'm Martin Malley. I'm one of the developers that work on Dynamic Language Runtime.
Absolutely. And you're famous for the LOL code.
Yeah, that was in fact, John came up with the idea. I was going to Barcelona to give a talk, and we have this little toy language that we play around in DLR when we want to experiment with ideas. We just hack on that because it's small and well-contained.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought I would demo that, and John says, well, you need a real language, you know, something that people know about. How about this lolcode thing? So I'm like, let me read about it. And 10 minutes later, I did some research, and I say, well, yes, I have to do this. So I gave myself 2 days to write it, and
nice.
It worked out, and people liked it. So
absolutely. And you talked about it at lang.net, right?
Yeah. So,
It's going to follow you around for the rest of your career. You know that, right?
Yeah, I've been trying to dissociate myself from it because it was really a joke, and unfortunately... So,
let's talk about what it demonstrated, right? I mean, you did it for a reason.
Well, it demonstrates that you can take a reasonably defined language, dynamic language, which LaCode is, and fairly simply implement it on DLR.
Mm.
And you know, all you need is to write a parser, a tokenizer, and then you use the DLR as a backend to generate the code, and then you just focus on the language semantics. Which I didn't spend too much time on, but if you really want to get the language right, then you really focus on the language semantics and implement the dynamic behaviors as the language defines them.
Hmm. Excellent. So let's dig into the DLR a little bit today. Why don't you just give us a quick overview of what this virtual machine is?
So the DLR, the idea behind the DLR is, I think there's several things, and I think what's interesting about our team is I think we're going to have multiple people that will agree and disagree on exactly what it is, right, what its ultimate goals are. But I think there's several interesting pieces. One piece is the fact that it provides a common set of hosting interfaces. So the common set of hosting interfaces is interesting in the sense that someone that wants to consume the DLR, right, simply needs to host the DLR, and the languages that are implemented on the DLR effectively come along for free.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of these different kinds of hosting scenarios that do show up, right? So you can imagine, you know, taking a DLR-based language and embedded in an Office, for example, right? Or embedding inside of Silverlight, which is another host that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
So this notion that, you know, someone that wants to host you or use these languages doesn't need to essentially host a bunch of different random languages, right, and deal with however they want to plug into or how they've defined their hosting interfaces. So that's one level where it's interesting. Another thing is for the people that are implementing these languages, there's a lot of goo, right, that people have to implement themselves, right? Effectively, each language has to re-implement this goo. So the goo could be things like, you know, code generation. It could be things like, you know, generating the PDBs so you get good debug info and the rest of that. And that goo isn't particularly interesting in a lot of cases. It might be for guys like Martin, right? He loves building the goo, right? But you know, but a lot of it is, you know, how can we make it easier for people to build stuff?
Yeah.
There's some other goo, right, that you have to write, and that's the stuff that, for example, you have to go off and you want to do .NET interop, right? Because clearly that's a big point of, you know, building these languages.
Absolutely.
On top of the runtime. I know a lot about that goo because that's what I built before I came to the company, and I built this open source bridge called RubyCLR. And what RubyCLR did was it allowed you from the existing Ruby programming language,
mm-hmm,
to interoperate with .NET types as if they were Ruby objects, right? You know, side by side inside of the same process.
Interesting.
And that's all RubyCLR did, right? And it took me an awful long time, right, just to build that piece, right, so that you would get this really nice seamless interop, so that the interop would feel very Ruby-like. You know,
mm-hmm.
So, you know, there are things like, you know, automatically translating names of methods from, you know, the way the CLR libraries define the methods to the way a Ruby programmer would expect to be calling methods with those same names.
Mm.
To other things like making things like, you know, .NET collections feel like they were Ruby collections at the same time, right? So there's a lot of that kind of stuff which you could effectively get for free, right, you know, through a set of libraries, right, which is what DLR effectively gets you.
Mm-hmm.
Should I tell them about the pipe tree? So the pipe dream is, well, so the way I kind of think about it, right, is there's this holy grail that we would like to get to, right? And the holy grail is a sense that today we have the desire to consume .NET libraries, right, as they're implemented today. And the vast majority of .NET libraries today are implemented in C#. There's a secondary thing, which is, okay, well, assume that we now have this ecosystem of a whole bunch of dynamic languages, right? Mm-hmm. And we would now want these dynamic languages to perhaps consume each other's libraries.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, I'm going to have a Python library, I'm going to consume it from Ruby, right? Or, you know, export some stuff to JavaScript. So there is also that other goal, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, so in a sense, the way you get to something like that would be to find something kind of like what the CLS is, right? Or the DLS, right, the dynamic language subset, let's say, right, you know, where you know, if you're a library implementer, you would have to implement DLS-compliant libraries in order to participate and play equally, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's a much harder challenge, right?
Sure.
Because a lot of these languages aren't particularly well-defined, you know.
Ruby being one of them, I mean, in the sense that that's, we talked about that in Ruby.net interview at lang.net.
Yeah.
They're trying to figure out, they're trying to come to consensus what Ruby is.
Yeah, and the problem with Ruby is that Ruby is whatever the current implementation of Ruby is, right? So, you know, Matt's pretty well says, well, it is what the current interpreter says, you know, it behaves as. And, you know, so without a specification, and also without us being able to really change the language at all, right? Because we don't own the language, right? You know, we have to respect the guy that created the language. And he has a final say in terms of what is the language, what isn't the language. You know, and we can't just add things, right, in order to make life easier, right, for, you know, doing this scenario, that scenario that he didn't anticipate.
Absolutely. I mean, as you were talking about the interoperation between different languages, clearly MSIL is the glue, right? If
yeah.
you get your language, parse it down to MSIL, you can play with the CLR, right? You
sure.
can play with the base class library.
Yeah.
It's a lot of what the work is, at least part of the work, is just being able to take code, spit out MSIL, and at runtime.
Exactly.
So
yes.
I really want to dig in a little bit about the complexities of dynamic typing over a static virtual machine. So let's talk about what the DLR has to do such that it can interoperate with the static virtual machine like the CLR.
Well, there are two parts of it. One is definitely what DLR does or what the CLR does underneath for us. And another one is what the languages have to go through. And it is still a hard problem how to even express the types. So, for example, Python types don't look anything like the .NET types. You can add methods at will. You can remove things. You can change the inheritance chain at will. And that just cannot be modeled using the .NET standard types. That's once baked, they're done, and you can't change them. So Python essentially has modeled its own type system using live objects, if you will, within the Python part of the runtime, and it uses DLR machinery to support the dynamic functionality that Python itself implemented. So, for example, if you have an object of a given Python type and there is an operation that needs to happen on it, the DLR is running the code, and eventually we start asking questions back to Python, how do you do this operation on this object that I don't know anything about? And the object is going to respond, and it might be either the object or it could be Python runtime, if you will, answering the question. But ultimately, a DLR is going to learn and do the operations if it sees the same object again.
Okay.
So there is a lot of help from the language implementer and from the objects that are also written by the language implementer that DLR leverages this way by asking the right questions in the right time and learns as it goes.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's really dig into what exactly the DLR is, right? Can we just maybe draw some pictures or, you know, dive into this machine? Number one, it is a virtual machine, right? Runs over the CLR.
Yeah.
I still have a hard time understanding exactly how you guys are able to efficiently communicate with the CLR, which is baked in type system. You sort of alluded to it just now, but you must be doing a lot of tricks, or what's going on?
Yeah, so we can really draw a picture. And maybe before we start drawing, I would just say one thing. The more I think about the DLR, the the more the parallel I would draw between CLR and DLR is that CLR is essentially something that runs chunks of IL. If you take an IL, maybe it also is a class description with some metadata around it, but ultimately you take a piece of IL, you give it the machine, and the machine's going to run it. And the DLR, on the other hand, runs similarly, but on trees. So you throw trees at it, it's going to do some work with them.
Mm.
And within the trees, there are places which are not super well defined at what we would call compile time, when we translate from the trees into IL. And at that point, DLR will compile into something that asks for help at runtime.
Mm.
So, and then there is a whole big machinery about how these questions at runtime get asked, how they get answered, who answers them, and there are many lines of code written about trying to figure out what the default answer should be if nobody else says better. So, for example, if a Ruby is looking for a count member on a hash table, it really doesn't matter to Ruby that it is, or it shouldn't matter to Ruby that it is a .NET object. There should be some default answer, if you will, for if you're Lolcode. So without any work, actually, Lolcode could look for count on hash table because DLR does this magic already.
Interesting.
So do you want to draw some pictures?
Yes, we do.
Yeah, I think a good picture, perhaps, is to sit down and think about, you know, what a type looks like, right? Because there's this weird thing, right? Because you alluded to it earlier, right, where we have a type that is a .NET type, right? But we also have types that are represented by the individual languages, right? So
yeah.
Ruby has a notion of type, Python has a notion of type,
mm.
right? And that causes an awful lot of confusion, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of people say, well, you know, yeah, we can add things and subtract things from things. Mm-hmm. What if I want to, from C Sharp, right, mm-hmm. grab a hold of one of these types? So what is the type of something, right? You know,
mm.
I'm going to walk up, somebody hands me a Python object, right, says, hey, what type are you? Right. How do you answer that question? I think that's actually something good to stick
absolutely.
On
that's a hard one, though.
it is
on the spot, man.
That's a hard one because people were historically asking us. So, you know, I take a class in Python. I actually write class something, inherit from something, and put a bunch of methods on it. And you know, they say now I'm done with it. I would like to use it from C Sharp. And we kind of go, it's nice, but it's really hard to do because the class doesn't look anything like the classes that would fall out of C Sharp compiler.
Mm.
Essentially, the class compiles down to a bunch of little tiny methods, individual methods, if you will, on IL level. And the fact that it looks like class to Python is essentially glorified dictionary, if you will, which is a name of the method and little pointer to a delegate, which is backed by some IL.
Mm.
But there is no strongly typed class from the sense of .NET
mm.
class built around it. So these guys don't look anything like .NET classes. And that's why, and they're so specific to Python, and that's why Python needs to implement a bunch of the operations on these, but that's all Python really needs to do.
Interesting.
It's hard enough, though, to implement it for Python, because as the class conversion, for example, you add a method on it, you remove one, and what DLR might have learned earlier about the class that, you know, if you see this class, this is the member you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
If the member's gone, what happens? Would DLR crash or not? So there has to be operations protected from this versioning problem also.
So it seems to me that there would be another good thing to talk about related to that, which is, you know, you've talked a lot about this learning thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to talk a little bit more about, well, how do you teach DLR stuff, right? You know,
yeah.
And what's this mechanism? I think, because that's a useful, I think that's probably a more concrete thing to talk about.
Yeah. And the type's going to build on top of it. You know, then we realize, actually, that it doesn't really matter what the type is.
Ah.
If it is .NET hash table, it might matter to DLR because DLR can do stuff on it on its own.
Mm-hmm.
But if it is a Python type, which doesn't look anything like C-sharp class, if you will,
mm-hmm.
then DLR can't do much, but still, with Python's help, can do a lot.
All right.
So I would... Do you want to
Let's dig
draw
into
some
it.
Pictures?
Of
yeah?
course.
We like pictures.
Yeah.
We like whiteboard.
So...
Yeah, we're cool.
So, starting with Python... Let's see, we could do C, and it has a dev foo on it that takes self and x, and what it does is say just print x. So as I said before, there is going to be no class on the other side, if you will, and the class body, from Python's perspective, is just some code that it gets executed and fills in a dictionary. So at the end, after this gets executed, there will be a dictionary with foo in it, which points to Python method. Which then has this code in it, the printx. So how does this all get built? When the Python parses this thing, it builds its own AST, which is some kind of class C thing, which is a body with a bunch of statements. One of them is def statement, which also has a body with a bunch of statements. One of them is printx. So then Python does that, and only Python can decide what the language syntax is, and Python did. It's actually fairly well spec'd, okay, given that it's a fairly new language, unlike Ruby. And so where do you go from here? Right. Something at the end is going to be DLR receiving end. So what Python does, it's going to transform this syntax tree into what we call DLR tree. If you played with link expressions, these won't be too foreign to you, except the link expressions really represent only expressions, whereas these guys represent also statements, because we have to represent real languages in here, not just expression subset of languages. So just this function, for example, would look like, on the DLR side, like code block, which takes two args. One is called self and is an object. The other one is an x and also is an object. And the print statement would be, it's also part of Python's definition, but DLR doesn't know anything about a print statement, so DLR, on the DLR side, Python would choose to express it as some call to Python ops.print. And print that. It'd be just reference to the variable.
Okay.
So this is a tree representation. We're actually making a lot of changes in it now to make it cleaner and better defined. So this is how the function is represented, and once DLR compiles it, it's going to become essentially a delegate to underlying IL, you know, which you can imagine what it would look like.
But wait a second, Martin. There's a step. Isn't there a step that happens before that, right? So when we're actually running these trees, right, there's going to be a step where we actually execute the trees themselves, right, before we go through the compilation step.
Once you get the tree, there is, of course, two basic options you can do. You can interpret them without going to IL. So if you have a simple tree, for example, which is just plus 2 of 2, it might be actually easier to just interpret the thing and get the result quickly rather than compiling into IL, creating the delegate, making sure that it gets jitted underneath and all this stuff. So for some things, it actually is better to interpret than compile. For these bigger chunks of code, you would have to pass explicit flag for us to actually go interpreting them. We would just compile them. There are snippets of code that we'll see a little later, which we would just interpret for several reasons. The perf being one of them. So once the language translates into its own abstract syntax tree, does analysis it needs to do, builds the DLR trees, then it just pushes a button, tells DLR, hey, this is my tree, let's run. Now, a little bit more about the trees. They're very much like Ling. They are statically typed, which is odd because they should run dynamic languages. So how do you express the dynamic operations in them? So, for example, if if this didn't say print X, I just simplify the case, and it just says A or X, Y, and it says return X plus Y, then what happens here, right? It's the question. We don't know what X is, we don't know what Y is, it can be anything from strings to ints to hash tables. So Python will essentially say, all I know within the tree. So it's going to define this code block, and it's going to take two things. X is an object, Y is an object. And within it, if we knew the types, if this were an int, but it's not, we could easily just say, create a node which is binary add. This is an int of, you know, points back to the parameter, and this will also be int that points to this parameter, very much like link. Yeah, in fact, in link, you would probably write it something like x, y, x plus y. That's
okay.
It. So if it is the dynamic operation, that we don't know what it is, we don't know these types, Python would essentially say that is some dynamic, and we call it now action. And the actual AST node, or the tree node, is called action expression. And it expresses the operation itself and has a list of arguments. So there will be two of them, the left one and the right guy, for addition. So all this expresses is essentially, I don't know what the left guy is going to be, I don't know what the right guy is going to be, but I know for sure that I'm going to be trying to do addition when it comes to the runtime time.
Okay.
So what happens at the cogen side, DLR essentially creates little, at the point of the plus, DLR will essentially invoke little object. We'll stash an object off to the side, which we call a site. So we have this site going on somewhere on the side. And there are many places where this guy can go, and you don't have to worry about it. We'll do it for you. And at the place of the plus, we'll essentially evaluate the left side. We'll evaluate the right side. And then invoke the site. With these two guys. And this is where the learning process starts. When the site is initialized, this invoke method, all it does is ask for help. Doesn't know what to do, so essentially it's going to turn around and call DLR, hey, I need some help. I'm holding an int, and the other guy is a string. What to do, right? So this would be kind of a pathological case, depends what the language defines, but something closer to home may be adding two integers.
Sure.
Right? So when this site gets invoked, the question is going to get asked to the DLR, help. And I have 3, and I have 4, and also we have this information coming in, which is, and I'm doing the addition. At this point, DLR is going to start looking at these arguments and figure out their types and also figure out what's the currently executing language. So if this is Python, we wrote it in Python, it would be Python. It would first package these things up and ask Python, how do you do this, Python? And Python can either say, well, I know how to do this, and tell the DLR how to do this operation, or it can say, no, I don't know how to do that. If it doesn't know, then there is a big piece of code in DLR that answers these questions. For example, for integers, it's going to figure out how to add them in the sort of C-sharp-ish way, if you will.
Mm.
It also would know how to do the hash table dot count, because that's something, if you see a hash table, if you're looking for count for it, on it, there's a very obvious way, obvious answer to that question. You know, this is the property you want to call. But if Python chooses to know what to do, for example, if these are big integers, so it'd be like 3 to the power of 50 and 4 to the power of 50, maybe big integers, and Python can add them, and only Python knows how to do that, because the big integer we can, for now, assume that, say it's a Python-specific primitive type. Mm-hmm. So Python would then provide the answer how to do this. How does the answer come back to the DLR? It's in the form of the ASD again.
So another tree.
Yes.
Okay.
And then DLR will take this tree, compile it down, maybe with other answers it got from previous questions. For example, another one was, I'm adding high, shell 9. So another answer came in the form of another tree. And what DLR will then do, take this green tree, take this red tree, and create IL from it, which essentially implements the green semantics, the red semantics, and at the end is going to insert help. And the help will then call back to DLR if we happen to see things we haven't seen before.
Mm.
We're going to cry for help again, go through this round trip. DLR is going to package the values, ask the language, do you know how to do this? Yes, I do. So we have another red tree or another green tree. And this list of answers, cache, if you will, is going to grow. If the language doesn't know, DLR is going to try to answer itself, for example, by looking for, you know, some simple answers, such as give me count of a hash table.
Hmm.
And this list will grow. And the assumption, of course, is that the languages and the programs behave well. Even though this function is written in a very general way, chances are that during the execution of a program, it's going to get called with integers for the most part, or maybe strings, but nothing crazy, really.
Yeah.
So, you know, this might grow a little bit. Chances are most of the time it's going to be simple case, one of the trees we got as an answer, so we're just adding integers. Chances are maybe somebody passes strings to us, so we have two cases in there. It would have to be really pathological to outgrow this out of some reasonable bounds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what it really happens. So just to recap,
sure.
If there is a dynamic operation anywhere in the program, and for Python they're everywhere, you know, you could have also return x comma high, it would also be dynamic operation.
Mm.
There is plenty of them. All of them get encoded as these dynamic expressions. We call them action expressions that encode the operation itself and have a list of arguments. What DLR will do, create this site or a cache, stash it off to the side, and at the place where the operation actually happens, would simply emit invoke into the site and just call an invoke method, which in turn will call a delegate, which encapsulates this black code. And when the delegate is initialized, it's just going to have the help in it.
Hmm.
This bottom piece. And, of course, as we call first time through it, we get some values, 3 and 4. DLR asks the language, how do you add 3 and 4? And language says, I don't care, do whatever. That's how log code operated on everything, pretty much.
Log I don't care, whatever.
Yeah, it didn't care about anything, but DLR did all the answering. So if the language doesn't care, DLR will try to figure out the default answer, and many things will work. And provide the answer in the form of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the course of iterating through this cycle, the number of trees might grow. If it's really bad case, we're going to have a lot of them, and we have cases in the DLR. We have checks for that, and so we semantically correctly handle all of it. We just will run faster if the site itself behaves sanely, if you will. It doesn't grow out of bounds.
And that, in essence, is really up to the language designer, right? I mean, the people that implement their languages on top of the DLR.
Well, I would say that's more of what the programmer who wrote the program is intending, right?
Yeah.
So these things are... So in the pathological cases, right, you would literally have to have tons of different types flowing through at the call site, right? So mm-hmm. So I think one important thing to emphasize here mm-hmm. is that one of these sites exists at each call site,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, so there's lots of these things all over the program, right? So each place where you did an X plus Y would effectively be a different site, right, inside
yeah.
of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And So you would really have to have this weird case, right, where you're just getting random input of lots of different types, and it's really hard to imagine too many things in real programs, right, where you would run into this case.
Sure.
And if you do, you just kind of pray that that's not sitting on the critical path inside of your code, right? Otherwise, we're not going to perform well in that scenario at all.
So I guess really what I was asking was that at the language level, when you, and you'd mentioned this earlier, if I have a type system that we don't understand, right, or I pass you a type that you don't know what exactly I mean, it's up to me to provide you guys with a tree, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. that you then convert into the help
yep.
construct.
Mm-hmm.
And the DLR tries to do stuff with it.
Yeah.
So what are some examples of where you guys just can't work? That's a really hard, you know, question in the sense that...
So there is a... I would turn it around, and I guess the question to me is not where we cannot work. We can always work. Because it just... The program would crash if we didn't do our job here. You know, having two things that can be added, but we fail to add them because we broke inside that we don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are things that just cannot be added because the language defines so. For example, JavaScript, I believe, adds strings and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
There are languages that would even say if there is a number embedded within the string, like so.
I think VB does the same thing, doesn't it?
It would actually add plus one, and the result wouldn't be, as some believe, 31 as a string, but it would be 4 as an integer.
Yeah, so I think JavaScript does the opposite of that, right?
Yeah, language defines which of the two happens, and valid answer is an error. So when this question is being asked of the language, how do you add 3 string plus 1 integer,
mm-hmm.
we might get exception.
Okay.
And that's really fine. It's like runtime exception that you would get when you try to cast integer to a string inside CLR program.
But if the program explicitly tells you that when you get a string and the plus operator and an int, you make it a string. Right?
Yes.
What if it explicitly tells you to end up with this result?
With this one?
Why would you throw an exception?
Yeah. We wouldn't.
Okay.
We won't.
Got it.
Because the AST, the tree that we get from the language, is going to describe, take the first guy,
mm-hmm.
take the second guy, and make it a string, and concatenate them. In fact, we could just write this piece of code that would do that. Do you want to do that?
Sure. But I John was saying, in reality, most programmers aren't going to do this. But then again, there could be the business type developer who just is trying to do something quickly and is used to having a lot of stuff happening implicitly for them, they might try to do this.
Then he's still playing within the constraints of the language.
Mm-hmm.
If Python defines that this addition is an error, then when DLR asks this question of Python, it won't get a tree back, it's just going to get an exception.
Interesting.
And if JScript defines that it's 31 as a string,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to get a tree which will say, take the first guy, it's a string, take the second guy, call
turn
two
string
on it, and concatenate the two.
Excellent.
And if it's VB or Perl, I don't know which language might choose to do this, it might actually give an AST back or tree back which will say, take the first guy, and we don't know what's in it at
mm-hmm.
that point. It's just opaque string to us. So just call some investigate string method. Try convert to integer. Yes. And that's going to either throw from within it once it's compiled into IL, or it's going to return 3 and add the other side to it and produce 4.
Very interesting.
So all of that is possible. And all of the semantics can be expressed via these trees that the languages will return. And Python will return different one than VB, even though they run on the same runtime. So that's how the language-specific behaviors are encoded.
Excellent. So just to re-summarize one thing, that the DL, when you think of the CLR, it operates on MSIL. The
mm-hmm.
DLR operates on
trees.
Abstract syntax trees. Provided by languages. Trees.
We don't have a good name for them. We started calling them ASTs historically because, you know, we had an Iron Python first, and that would compile into ASTs, and then would just emit IL directly, and then we introduced this middle layer of these, what we now call just trees, or some people call them statement trees, but they are no longer statements in them, even though they encode statements, but they became expressions recently. So the naming is odd in here, but...
D-tree.
D-trees, D-trees.
Now you have D-trees.
Some people call them semantic trees also.
Cool. Yeah.
But the trees, that's what the DLR runs on.
Outstanding.
And the dynamic behaviors get encoded by these special nodes within the trees that essentially mean, I don't know yet, but I'm going to know at runtime, ask me later. And then if you will, then we take the actual values, ask the question, get a tree back. So you can think about it as if we were inlining these trees, the concrete hardened, where we figure out the types, where we know that this 3 is an int and this 4 is an int also. So we take these guys as if inlining them in the original, you know, original expression, not here, but in here, as if replacing this plus with all these specialized versions.
Hmm. Interesting. And at the same time, you guys are performant. I was looking at your results at the lang.net. That must be a challenge to some degree, huh?
It is.
Constantly
it is
working on that?
Well, that's a never-ending kind of thing there's plenty of work. I don't think, you know, DLR is going to be done, right, anytime soon, right, in the sense that we would be finished doing it. But there was actually one thing I really wanted to kind of touch upon here,
sure.
Right, to kind of circle all the way back to types, right, what we were talking about right at the start of this thing is.
Yeah.
So in this case, right, the example that we had up there, we had this method, foo, right, our canonical method.
Yeah.
So if we started with foo, it was, let's say it was a method that was on some type, right,
mm-hmm.
class C.
Yeah.
Let's say that we added something or we changed type C somehow, right? But yet we have all of these sites kind of like just lurking around, right, in lots of different places, right? How do we tell those sites that, you know, something has changed? Right? I think this is nice because then this allows us to kind of tie back into types, right,
mm.
and what
yeah.
we were talking about earlier. So I'm going to make Mark go back up there and erase everything he did so he can draw.
But we have it recorded.
So we have this foo thing. Just the canonical case. And I guess the question now would be, how do you... So you have an instance of this thing. And then you do c.foo. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a dynamic operation. At runtime, we know that C's type is C, which is this class, and we're looking for foo at it, on it. But this dot is the dynamic operation, so it's going to be also encoded in the resulting tree after we compile this source code as the dynamic or action expression, which is the encoding of the operation is going to be get member. Foo. Essentially, this means, and it takes one argument, which is going to be the C. Essentially, what this means is, I don't know what the C is going to be at runtime, but no matter what I pass you, look for foo on it.
Mm.
So the first time we call this, we would invoke through the site, and we would ask for help, and DLR will pose the question to Python, hey, I've got this C, and I'm looking for foo on it. That's the two pieces, the actual value of C at runtime and the description of the operation. And then, so there are two sub-questions, if you will, DLR is going to ask. One is, maybe the object is smart object, and it knows how to find whatever on itself. It essentially answers its own questions. It's a good guy. He knows how to do stuff. Ints are really stupid, if you will. They don't know how to answer anything, so we have to fall back to some bigger, generic answering.
Is that true for all primitives? They're dumb, in your definition?
Yes, they don't know how to answer their own questions.
Sure.
Somebody else has to do it for them. But this C guy, he's an instance of the class. Maybe he's smarter. So
okay.
That's the first question DLR is going to pose. Are you smart guy? And for example, the class itself is smart. It knows how to make its own instances, for example. It knows how to look up members on itself. So the first two sub-questions that happen within the DLR is the object smart? Which means it implements interface iDynamic object. If it does, DLR asks the question to the object directly. If it doesn't, it's going to ask the language itself the currently executing language and pass the C to it and pass the description of the operation. So either way, at the end of the day, we will hopefully receive a tree exception or a null.
Okay.
If it is a tree, everything's peachy, everything runs. If it's exception, language just doesn't implement the thing. And if it is null, DLR is going to try to figure out the default answer, like adding integers. Let's see. So if it is this get member, I don't know actually from the top of my head whether C becomes a smart object in DLR. If Python implementation makes it so that C is smart, I believe so.
Okay.
So we're going to go through the first route, and out on the other end is going to come out the tree. Now, what if somebody says, as the next line here, c.foo equal some kind of bar, and the bar could be a method sitting outside like so. So I essentially rewrote, maybe, let's see, return I am a foo, and this guy returns I am a bar. So from now on, if I do C, this is uppercase C, let's rename the class to X. So I'm changing the class itself. I change the foo to now be some other function, and I want to call C foo. So in here I would expect to get foo back. Now I changed it, you know, I would expect to get bar back. But if you think about it, it's the same instance. So if the tree in here that encodes the operation doesn't guard from these events, it could very well mean that the answer to give me member of foo on C would be the same in both of these cases. And that's what John was alluding towards, that the types fall out of this thing because once they update, we have all these sites lurking around. This is one, this is the other, that need to be in some way updated or invalidated or something needs to happen. Because if nothing happened, we would get foo string back as opposed to what we expect, bar, right? So when this update happens, this one, x.foo equal bar, where we change the method itself, what Python runtime does is going to change the version of x. So the class x has a version flag on it, if you will, and it's going to change. And when we come to the next site, the tree that describes the operation also checks for the version, and the test will fail because the version has changed. So in a little more detail, when we got the answer to give me, how do you get foo out of C from Python at first? The answer would look like something, if C, or if the arg, is Python object and Python object arg version equal version before update, whatever it was at the time, then return this foo, original foo. Right? So then somebody updated the class, the version was updated to something. When we hit this call site, or even better, what we should do is run on the same call site, because this would be a different one, be a different cache, and things will look a little differently. So let me change that a little bit. We have a function here, member function, that takes whatever object, and no matter what you give it, it returns o.foo. So the first time you come through here, you call m on o, on c, then you do x.foo equal bar from up there, and then you call it again. And c is an instance of x. So that's our repro. Create instance, call it, here's the dynamic expression, the dynamic site at runtime, update the class, call again. So first time you run through here, through this dot, DLR asks Python, how do you do that? And Python answers, this is how you do it. We check for the argument, make sure that it's a Python object, and then its version is whatever it was when we hit it the first time. And we're literally checking for the version of the class, but you know, you get the idea. Second time when we update the class, the version is going to change. So this thing's going to change. And when we call again, we run through this code and fall on the other end because the version was different. It is still a Python object, but the version's different. So we're going to come down here to where DLR inserts the help call, drop down into the runtime, ask the question again, and we get an answer back which looks very much like this, except with the version in the check is going to be version after update. So now you would wonder, you had one tree that came from the first question. First question came from here, and it said version before update. And there was another tree that was the answer after the update, and the constant in it was version after update. Now, earlier, I said the DLR will take these trees and essentially take the red one and take the green one, insert the cry for help at the end, and wrap this into delegate, right? If we did that, literally, we actually suboptimal, because the red tree, we know for sure the version won't go down. It's gone, right? The object's been updated, and even if I change it to foo back, I don't really know that that's what happened, so I have to up the version again. So essentially, this tree is obsolete and is going to be obsolete forever. So if this happens, as we rebuilding the delegate, as we putting the pieces together, we check, is this tree even valid anymore? So we ask it, are you still valid? And the tree will say no because the version's wrong. This one will say, yep, I'm valid. So we'll insert it, but this one is going to get thrown away. And that's how the cache ages.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So that's how it works.
Well, I think it's getting clearer for everyone.
Well, is it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We know it's clear to you. So what happens in the case if the class is static? Does it make any difference, right, in terms of versioning?
You mean static?
So those are instances. I'm not a Python programmer. Is there a concept of static classes in Python? I mean, in dynamic languages?
In Python, everything is this dynamic, but maybe where things will change substantially if you're dealing with .NET class, because it's a hash table. Nobody can modify a hash table. Mm-hmm. No, it's done. It's baked. In which case, the expressions that will fall out of the ask for help will not have checks like this, and they will essentially be if arg is hash table return some representation of hash table count, for example. And by the sum representation, it is going to be an object that encapsulates the instance and the property, but it has... Now in Python, it will have been called. So in fact, it's going to be return hash table arg dot count. That's it. And because this code is fully static, it's essentially dispatched directly to method info of the get underscore count.
Okay.
It's going to burn into IL, like, you know, and then into x86. It's going to be super optimal, essentially. There is no dynamicness here. Uh-huh. What we did is arg a hash table, this is how you get count. Cast into hash table and call the getter. That's it.
And that's that secret optimized code path, right, that the JIRA guys, you know, put in, right?
Yeah, yes.
So now what if the calling code, so the currently executing language code, you gets back a type that it doesn't formally understand. So, I mean, what I'm saying is you give me back a .NET type, I'm a developer and I'm working against the CLR and I throw right. in my type and right. you guys pass me something back.
So, for example...
You pass me a tree back?
No. So, let's say that you're doing operations such as hash table, give me something at index high, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what you get back. Is that roughly what you're asking?
Yeah.
Then whatever was at that index high, you get back and it's... As a language implementer, you don't know where it came from. It could be one of these instances because somebody put it into the hash table previously. It could be another CLR object. It can be anything. So once you get this guy, you can stash it away in some some variable. So far, so good. It's when you start doing operations on this guy, when you will start asking questions, does O have foo?
Mm-hmm.
You know, can I do O plus 5? Can I call O? Then it becomes interesting, right? So we're still running within Python, and whenever this operation happens, these all are the dynamic operations. So I'm going to start asking the same questions, or the DLR will start asking the same questions. How do you get foo from yourself? Or if the object doesn't know, maybe it's an int, maybe it's the object that is not one of these guys, then we'll ask the language. And that's when it gets really interesting. If it is CLR, what if it's another hash table, or if it's a list of int, for example? Python doesn't know about all these things, and it shouldn't, because that's DLR's job. If, you know, you might say it's a DLR's job, because DLR runs on CLR. It should just give me access to anything that is CLR. So if it's list of int, Python will say, I don't know what to do. So the question, how do you do this? I need help to figure out how to do this dynamic operation.
Mm-hmm.
Python will say, I don't know. Here's a null. You know, go figure it out. And then DLR will look at this list of int and figure out, DLR doesn't have a foo, right? So it's going to become an error. What if somebody said it's a count, asking for count? Python will say, I don't deal with lists. I don't know. Return null instead of a meaningful tree. Then DLR will take the second shot and say, well, always a list of int, and it's just through reflection as get member called count. And is going to get a response and say, yep, here's one, and it happens to be a property, so I can do the same code that we saw down here earlier. So if an object falls from the sky, or it was stored by somebody else into some data structure, and you just fish it out as Python or Ruby, then DLR will ask the same question the same way. Ruby or Python will say, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And then DLR will try to figure out and do its best. And in many cases, the best is actually the right thing to do. Now, then, of course, you have questions such as, is Ruby... lowercase in general? Like, would the count be lowercase?
Yeah, so the count would be lowercase in Ruby.
Yeah, so in that case, Ruby would not give any answer, and DLR would probably do the wrong thing here, because DLR is case-sensitive, so if you ask for lowercase count, possibly the wrong thing could happen. However, just by simple operation, the Ruby could inspect the CLR type, ask for lowercase count first, wouldn't find it, of course, and then turn around and say, well, you know, I'm case instance, or I'm generally lowercase, so I'm going to ask for capitalized count. Whoop, here it is, and build the tree as an answer. So it's not much work on the language side to get even tricks like that working.
Interesting.
Yeah, and that lookup, that whole reflection of the actual type happens once when you get the type that you haven't seen before. So you can take your time, figure it out, and then it gets burned into IL and x86 or x64 and runs fast.
Outstanding, man.
Yeah.
Very, very cool stuff, you guys. So you're basically like a mega MSA IL generator. Huh?
Yeah, we're a better reflection of it.
right on. I mean, it seems like that. That's
yeah.
what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very
and
cool.
You can almost think about, like, you know, DLR trees as being DIL, right? Dynamic intermediate language, right? Because you, there's nothing really to stop you, right, from formally specifying what the semantics are of those trees are in some kind of language, right? You can have, you know, effectively. So Martin's actually done a lot of work to provide this dumping utility, which will dump out what these things look like, right? And so the thing you dump out is kind of almost like its own little language, right?
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. So the way, for example, in CLR, you have a ildasm, I believe it's called.
Yep.
You throw an assembly at it. Reflector is kind of the next step. Let's talk about ildasm only for now. So in ildasm, you just look at il as text, and you can also spit it out into a file, make some changes, and it's reversible. You can make an assembly out of it again. These trees, as you dump them using the little utility, they are essentially, that's one, you know, it just takes the output. But feasibly, you could write a compiler of the text representation of the trees in the same way ILASM does reverse of what ILDASM does.
Hmm.
So you could build a tree, dump it as text, and compile it back into the tree representation in the program.
Interesting.
We haven't done it yet, but it'd be cool. At least, you know, like if there's an intern out there who'd be interested, it'd be pretty cool.
Some
should get Roshan.
Yeah.
That would be an interesting project.
Yeah.
Very cool. So, you know, one of the things that makes me think about is the consequences of this in terms of the evolution of the CLR. And what I'm asking is, are you guys, you know, is there going to be some day where, I mean, this is totally hypothetical, but I would just wonder, like, you know, pulling the type system out of, unbaking the type system in the CLR, is that something that the CLR team considers? I mean, no. Because that would kind of mess with verifiability and type safety, or what? I mean, I'm interested in the, you know, this whole dynamic thing has come across is a new thing for Microsoft, right? I mean, you came on board here to help us become more dynamic.
Well, I think, you know, there's a school of thought certainly out there that says that you should be able to implement a CLR on top of a DLR, right? In the sense that if you started off with a dynamic runtime to begin with, right, that you can just add static typing semantics on top of that. I mean, that's effectively what the Lisp guys have already done, you know. So there's plenty of kind of past history to say that this is the case.
Mm.
Now, whether or not that's practical or not, whether or not you should invest all that money to make something like that happen, that's not my call, right? But
understood.
It's, you know, it certainly seems like it's something that could be done just based on prior art, right? But whether or not it's something worthwhile doing is a whole separate question.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I like to ask the sort of random, non-worthwhile questions once in a while.
Sure.
It just seems interesting to me, because the core architecture of the CLR made... I mean, what you guys have done with the DLR is rocket science in many ways. I mean, you've written a lot of code.
Yes?
Yeah, we've written a lot of code.
It's a hard problem. I mean, let's look at the Ruby.net guys, right? I mean, I interviewed Wayne Kelly, who's now joined the Iron Ruby Party, which is very cool. They wrote that great parser.
Yep.
They spent 2 or 3 years trying to implement a dynamic language on top of the CLR, and they had a hell of a time. And in fact, we hired Jim Huggins, who was beginning to write a paper about how it's impossible to run dynamic languages. Now he works here. Now, the DLR is really what made that all possible. If you didn't have the DLR, then one could argue that, yes, you'd have a hell of a time.
Yeah, and that was the evolution, essentially, and when Jim Huguenin came to Microsoft, and later people started joining him to help out with Iron Python, it was a multi-year project, and DLR fell out of that as a product. But now that DLR is available, it is no longer a multi-year project to implement LAL code or Ruby, for that matter. It is still effort to get all the edge cases of the language itself right, to make sure that the class is versioned correctly, to make sure that it performs well, to make sure that adding string to an integer works just right as the language defines it. But because you don't have to do code gen, you don't have to do a lot of the work that you would otherwise have to do when you write compiler. then you have time to focus on what's really important to the language itself.
Absolutely. So to end, what's coming up for the DLR? I mean, what do you guys, you know, what you can talk about? What are you guys thinking up?
Well, we have to ship the thing, right?
So, well, that's
so I guess that's a big thing that's coming up. You know, so you know, our goal has always been to be at least done, right? You know, in the sense of being done, you know, by August of this year, right? And whether or not that's actually still the plan now.
Yeah,
that's still the plan.
I believe so.
Yeah.
And it's just a rough plan, so.
Yeah.
People
so this isn't a commitment, right, to ship by.
Well, we're Alpha 8 now. And,
in Python.
And DLR.
And DLR, DLR effectively,
they go
yes.
hand in hand.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
And
you're going to be talking at Mix.
So you know, we're going to be back at Mix this year, and we've got more things to show. You know, I'm doing a talk together with another guy on our team, Jimmy, and we'll be looking at how our stuff plugs into Silverlight. So there's a lot of so Silverlight's yet another one of these hosts, right? So Silverlight's going to host us, and by definition, we'll host all of the languages that we're building here at Microsoft. And you know, so we'll have managed JavaScript, we'll have Ruby, we'll have Python there as well.
Nice.
And so I think that, you know, we're going to be able to show some interesting scenarios, you know, about the kinds of things you can do from Ruby inside of the browser. One thing that I think is a particularly interesting case is we've got this lab that we're tentatively calling, you know, taking the J out of Ajax, right? You know, where we're going to go off and show effectively building Ajax-style applications, right? But by using different languages on the client side, right? You know, so we'll probably do it in Ruby, and we'll see, you know, the kinds of things we do, just programming HTML stuff, as well as also programming Silverlight stuff, you know, all within the context of the browser. So that's really what our talk makes is going to be all about.
That sounds really, really cool, man.
Yeah.
I'll have to check that out.
Cool.
If I'm not gambling.
No, we don't do things like that in Vegas,
of course,
right?
Not.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Yeah, it does. Very cool. Hey, it's been great to talk to you guys. I've been really curious about the innards of the DLR, and I've definitely learned a lot today. Hopefully, I'm sure everybody else out there did. Thank you for your time. I know you got a lot of code to work on, right? Developer
here. Yes, I do. Yeah, go back to coding.
Right on, man. Well, thank you so much, you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
See you in Vegas.
Will do.